When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And we don't just mean the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out, the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Hey, it's Will Friedle.
And Sabrina Bryan.
And we're the hosts of the new podcast, Magical Rewind.
You may know us from some of your favorite childhood TV movies, like My Date with the President's Daughter.
And the Cheetah Girls movies.
Together, we're sitting down to watch all the movies you grew up with and chat with some of your favorite stars and crew that made these iconic movies happen.
So kick back, grab your popcorn, and join us. Listen to Magical Rewind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin, the auto editor here at HowStuffWorks.com, and I'm joined by Ben. Hey Ben, what's your title this week?
This week, funny story, I actually got promoted. I am roundhouse coordinator.
Oh, very good. Very good. I've been known to give somebody a roundhouse here in the hallway.
That is true, yeah.
Yeah, things aren't going my way.
Well, we've just, you know, you know how it is. Sometimes in a big company, you got to cover all your bases. Mm-hmm. So there haven't been that many roundhouse-related tasks for me. Mostly I'm arranging my desk.
Oh, very good. Very good. Shuffling papers, things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Just looking busy.
Well, I would say that I am busy.
Oh, you definitely are.
So, yeah.
I try to walk with paper in my hand. That helps, too.
That's a good one. I've seen you doing that.
Yeah.
They told me to follow you specifically due to that.
Hey, you know what? Yeah. One quick thing before we get going here.
Yes.
I saw something this weekend that I thought I would share with everybody.
Is this another episode of Stuff Scott Sees?
It is. Yes, because I thought this was really unusual. And I'm going to show you a quick picture of this, and then I'm going to take it back. Because I saw one of these this weekend. I'm handing a photo over to Ben.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It's a Maserati Merak. And I saw it in a lot this weekend, a car lot, and it was rusting away to the point where you could see through the doors.
That's a shame.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, in terrible, terrible condition. But you look at it, and it's an Italian supercar, really, from the early 70s. It was built, like 72 to 82, and it had a V6 engine. It was like the Maserati Bora. If you're familiar with the Bora, then you know what this looks like. It has less glass in the back. It's got two great big flying buttress type beams that come down from the back, and it's a really awesome looking car, but really unusual to see that, and I don't know, just even, you know, it shows or anything like that, and here's one rusting away on this car lot with three other, I think it was old MGs that were there.
That's terrible.
Yeah, I know. I just really unique. I mean, when you look at it, it's a beautiful car. If they could just restore it back to original condition, but this one is in such poor condition, it needs completely redone. I mean, everything new, all bodywork, everything.
It's like a restoration that would be on a television show.
Yeah,
that level.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complete redo. But anyways, I thought that was a unique car to see on, you know, I don't know, just kind of by chance over the weekend.
Yeah, it's just sad to see. Maybe next time you see it, it'll be back to its original glory days.
I don't know. I've passed by this lot before, and it appears to be kind of a graveyard.
Oh.
Like maybe this is the last stop for this thing.
We should do something on car graveyards.
It seems like maybe it's scrap metal at this point.
Yeah, but we should maybe in the future do one on car graveyards.
Love that idea because I could comb through a junkyard for days looking for things. I don't even know what I would select out of there, but I like to just look and see what's there.
And also, you never know the story behind those cars or how they got there.
Ah, very good, Ben. You're right. Because there's always a story behind, well, every car, really. But some have, I guess, more fantastic stories behind them, right?
Yeah. And so what we thought we would do today is just something a little different. We're going to tell everybody about a couple of cars with unusual stories. Now, we've done this before in past podcasts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had a few that we've mentioned. What were some of the
Batmobile.
Oh, yeah, that's right, Batmobile.
James Bond cars.
Yeah.
James
Dean.
Yes, sir.
Remember we had James Dean's car.
And the Cursed Spider.
Did I say that right? James Dean's car. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, the Cursed car. That's right. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe were there some stories in the Hearse episode, maybe?
Yeah.
Possibly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yes.
I bet there were. But, you know what really got this rolling for us this week was that I went to, the show that's at the High Museum of Art here in Atlanta. And there's a show called The Allure of the Automobile. Mm-hmm. And they have, just some fantastic examples of cars from what they call the golden age of motoring, which is, according to them, 1930 to 1965. So these are some pre-war cars, a little bit of post-war cars, just beautiful, beautiful examples, like Duesenbergs and Pierce Arrows and things like that. Some of these cars were owned by famous people. Clark Gable had a couple of cars on exhibit there. Well, whoever owns them now, they were formerly owned by Clark Gable.
Right.
Steve McQueen's car was there. Of course, there was like a Stingray prototype, the Bill Mitchell car that we talked about.
Yeah.
Not the green blue one, but the silver one that they made, the Stingray convertible. Prototype, rather. There was a Tucker there, which I think
really?
Would pique your interest.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of your favorite cars,
yes,
right?
Yes, sir.
And one of the things that really really kind of got me excited was I was reading all the little stories that went along with these cars and how there's some fantastic history that goes along with a car that's 90 years old. So I thought maybe we'd talk about a couple of these. Like just as a quick example so that you know what we're talking about.
Yes, por ejemplo.
One of the Clark Gable cars was a 1935 Duesenberg, JN Roadster. And his wife gave him this car as a gift. Those Duesenberg gave him, as a gift, for quite a gift, I'll say. But
yeah,
she died apparently in 1942, and her name was Carol Lombard. So she died, and according to the Duesenberg Registry, they said that Gable left instructions for the vehicle to stay in Canada and never to return to the United States, specifically to California, where he lived while he was still alive. It was just too heartbreaking for him. He didn't want to have anything to do with that car, and that's where it stayed. So he owned this Duesenberg that just remained in Canada for X number of years until he died, and then it was brought back to the States and restored to its former glory. But that's just one tiny
example.
Little history,
yeah.
And there's a lot more. There's some that are far more interesting than that as you go along. But these cars are all restored to concours level. So these are the types of cars that you'd find at a concours show. And a lot of them, like I said, they if you talk to the owners or if you listen at the concours shows, you'll hear a lot of these stories.
Sure.
If you go to the judging booth or where, they can drive the vehicle through and you get to see it in motion. I told you I love that part.
Right, yeah.
But, you have to wait there as each one comes through and tells their story. And it could take, a
hours.
Full day or 2 days even as they make their way through this booth. But honestly, a lot of those stories are definitely worth it because you find out some just fantastic things in their history that you'd have no idea or no I guess there's no way to say why this car should even be here. It's that
right.
Some of them are very dramatic.
And then when you get to – that's an excellent point because when we get to a certain age with a car, one has to assume that there are just going to be stories that have grown up around it.
True.
You know, there's not one Model T in the United States where someone goes, well, I don't really know how that thing stayed running.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, when you look back at like the Corvette history. In 1953, Corvette was the car to own at one point, and a lot of them, there were very limited numbers. They were hand-built. They went to a lot of movie stars, a lot of celebrities, and so a lot of them have a history to them, and those are very desirable cars because they have this, you can look down the owner registry and find out who owned this vehicle, and it may be, an actress, an actor, movie star, some kind of local celebrity.
Head of state, even.
Exactly, yeah, heads of industry. So a lot of them, you'll find that, just with age comes these great stories. And that's the case with a lot of these that we're going to talk about today. We've only got a couple, really.
Yeah, let's jump into the first one.
Oh, go ahead. You want to go with the first one or you want me to?
Well, I've only got the one.
Okay.
I
got a couple. So in addition to that, let me, you know what? I'm going to skip one here. So
let's
we're doing this
one.
On the fly, but I'm going to show you a picture of this one right there.
Okay? Oh, wow. That's nice.
Light blue, huge car. It's a Rolls-Royce.
Rolls-Royce Phantom.
Now, I've seen this car in person. Mm-hmm. This was on display when I saw it at the Imperial Palace Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. It's part of the auto collections that they have there. Mm-hmm. You can, you know, pay $5 or whatever it is and go up and see these cars. And they're beautiful cars. They have Johnny Carson's car there, his first car, rather. They have all kinds of automobiles, and most of them are for sale, if not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Huge rotating collection. Well, this is a 1925 Rolls-Royce Phantom, and I specifically searched this one because I remember this story. Forgive me if I'm reading just a little bit from this, but this comes right from the auto collections website. So this car was one of the first new Phantoms to be built in 1925. Okay, it's an all-weather tourer, so it's a convertible, but it does have the side windows. You can add those.
Mm-hmm.
Records show that there was an accident shortly after it was loaded onto the docks and bound for America, and the cargo ship that it was carrying this vehicle ended up on the bottom of the sea. So this vehicle, along with this 1925 Rolls-Royce Phantom, which when you see it in person, it's like a concours car. It's beautiful, absolutely spotless.
Mm-hmm.
This thing has been at the bottom of the ocean, and it was recovered, you know, not long after that because they knew what was on board. It was a valuable cargo, you know, so they brought everything back up. They sent it back to the Rolls-Royce factory, and it was completely rebuilt, and they put a brand new chassis on it. So the bodywork, everything else is, you know, all original. Everything is original as can be.
Sure.
And then they kept it around as their development car for the next 3 years of its life. And this specific vehicle was said to be the personal transportation for Henry Royce for that period of time.
Really?
Yeah. So Henry Royce of Rolls-Royce fame was this was his car for 3 years. So you can imagine the value associated with something like this.
The car of the king, basically.
Exactly, yeah. And it was completely reconditioned by the factory in 1928, just prior to it being sold as a secondhand vehicle for a lot of money. But it was sold to a lady in Scotland, that's in quotes.
What's in quotes? Scotland or lady?
Lady is. Okay. Because it was apparently a noble lady of some type.
Okay.
They don't specify who. But it was just after the outbreak of World War II. And she donated the vehicle to be used in the Scottish Division of the Red Cross. So this vehicle then, now they cut the entire rear bodywork out. They removed the whole bodywork of the rear end of this vehicle, and they called it chopped down. But they turned it into an ambulance. So this Rolls-Royce, this 25 Rolls-Royce was an ambulance at one point in its life.
Wow.
And it's restored back to what, you know, the way it was. But what they said was really strange about this is because the color of the vehicle was changed from yellow over black. Color of the vehicle was previously changed to yellow over black, emulating the storyline of the Rolls-Royce chronicled in the film The Yellow Rolls-Royce. And then it was restored in the early 60s and brought back to its original color scheme, which was the blue that you see here.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1967, it was shipped back again to the United States via the Queen Elizabeth.
And it made the trip successfully?
So it's gone back and forth and back mm-hmm. and forth. It's this car that, you know, has been all over the place, and it's got this fantastic history with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, this thing – can you imagine this vehicle being on the bottom of the ocean?
It's about as difficult to imagine a Phantom being on the bottom of the ocean as it is to imagine a Phantom as an ambulance.
Right. You know, that's true.
To be candid.
Very
with you.
True. Very true.
That's crazy.
I know. So that's just one. This is one vehicle and one point in history that all of this happened to. And it could have just ended when they loaded it on the dock, you know, several days after it was built. And, oh, well, we lost that one.
So this vehicle right here, this one we're starting off with, has actually been shipwrecked and served in the military.
Yes.
Which is more than I've done with my life.
and greatly modified and then brought back and then mm-hmm. modified again and then brought back and just over and over. And it changes hands and it changes owners and they do what they want with it. And then eventually it comes back. You know, now it's back to its original, I guess, glory.
And what's the what's crazy is the question these always lead to, these sort of stories always lead to, is how in the heck did this thing survive and mm-hmm. Is it going to continue? Is this weird storied existence?
I don't know.
You know, because now a lot of them are safely locked away and supervised.
It could be. But, you know, let's say that it, you know, it's going to make the trip across again. Let's say that the owner wants to ship it back again. What happens if midway it, you know, it falls over the edge again, or, you know, not falls over, but, you know, the ship sinks again.
Sure.
What happens then? Do they restore it then? Do they bring it back up for a second resurrection?
Well, you know, a huge demographic of our audience is composed of treasure hunters, so hopefully it wouldn't be down there too long.
Treasure hunters. That'd be a cool job.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think about it on a daily basis. It's kind of weird.
You should go for it.
I should. Yeah. I should. All right, where are we going next?
All right, go ahead. Hit the one you got there.
I've got one that's a little weird. I'm going to take it down. We're doing the down and the weird stuff in the beginning, mm-hmm. so maybe we'll get to a happy ending later on. I'm going to butcher this, but Scott, what I would like to tell you about is a certain 1911 Graf und Stift double phaeton, which was driven by Archduke Franz Ferdinand. He was riding in it, used by him, mm-hmm. On the day of his assassination, mm-hmm. which, you know, many historians point to as the tipping point for World War I.
Yes.
Okay, so it's, you know, there are a lot of crazy things that people will say about this, but what we want to focus on is the car. Before I say anything about this, let me just tell everyone.
Is this a bad luck car?
This is a bad luck car.
Okay, got
this it. This is a James Dean cursed level car.
Okay, got it.
Which means that it's anecdotal and there's not really a way to prove this stuff.
Okay.
So here's what happens. Here's what they say. Let's see. Let's start on the day of the assassination, right?
Mm-hmm.
So after the first thing, you can blame it for being cursed, right? If you want to have it rack up a body count, as you could say, it is indirectly responsible for 20 million deaths in World War.
True. Yeah, I guess.
I think that's indirect, but
yeah, that's pretty, that's a big blanket statement.
So,
it says that?
It does.
Okay.
The internet says
right.
that.
Yeah.
You know, this is just like,
I see.
But okay. Actually, the person who says that is, listed as an intendant named Karl Brunner at the Vienna Museum.
Okay.
Where the phaeton is allegedly
held. I'd like it to be on the record that the car has nothing to do with the assassination.
I would also like that on the record, but, you know, this is part of the car's unusual story.
Understood.
So, okay, so after, unfortunately, the Archduke and the Duchess are assassinated, they have a governor of Yugoslavia who has the car restored and decides to make that his car. Now, this was... I've got a photo here. This was a pretty high class car, and
sure.
It was also painted blood red.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Uh huh. And so they, you know, it's a very controversial, exciting color. You know, makes quite an impression. So when they restore it, you can only imagine that they would have thought about the paint scheme. That comes into play later.
Mm-hmm.
So governor of Yugoslavia has this vehicle. Allegedly, he loses his right arm in an accident.
Hmm.
And he has multiple accidents, and he decides that the vehicle should be destroyed.
Mom always said, keep your arms inside the vehicle at all times.
Yes, and I know I have two, but I'd like to keep that myself. So he has a friend who's a doctor who thinks it's ridiculous that you would be superstitious about a car. So he has it, and then he drives it for a while, and apparently it overturns, and they find him dead beneath it.
Hmm.
And then another doctor owns it again. And then he sells it to a race driver, a Swiss race driver, and he dies. The race driver dies of a broken neck. A farmer has the car next, and this is all, of course, allegedly. I think
sure.
It has a bit of a conspiracy theory tang to mm-hmm. it. And then two farmers die in a mysterious tow car incident when the vehicle stalls and then starts of its own volition.
Hmm.
And then... they say the last private owner was a fellow by the name of Tiber Hirschfeld. And he decided, you know what, man? Maybe the problem here is just the red paint for some reason. So what did Mr. Hirschfeld do? He painted it blue. And he got some friends of his together and he said, hey, guys, let's go on a trip. Where he and the four guests died in a head-on collision.
No kidding.
Well, I mean, again, wow. There's not really an effective way to confirm this. You know, it's kind of a...
What's the body count up to at this point? Because
let's see. That's 5, 2, so we got 7, yeah. 8, 9.
Wow.
Not counting the Archduke.
This is crazy.
So counting them, it's up to 11.
I got to admit, that's a little bit... shady.
Well, sure, sure. And how, you know, again, how are we going to verify it? But it's a great story. And then, so the car is rebuilt after this collision. So how many times has it been repaired and rebuilt? And it's taken to a museum in Vienna. And then, eventually the Allied bombers bombed the building.
Oh, okay. So it was destroyed in the war.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. But there's also a lot of skepticism, which I tend to agree with, and says this story is kind of bunk.
Yeah.
Because it's weird to think that people would keep rebuilding the vehicle. But there's debate, you know, about whether or not the one on display is the real one. And there are a lot of people who say that the vehicle wasn't destroyed during the war.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there's this legend about the guy we mentioned earlier, Carl Brunner, how someone found his hands, just his hands, on the steering wheel.
Oh, come on.
And that's obviously not true. I had to save that one for the end.
Really?
That's
just
like
his
hands? That's like that campfire story, you know, about the guy with the hook.
With the hook,
who
sure.
comes up on the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is probably also not true.
You know
true.
What, Ben, though? Honestly, this is interesting. When I was going through the High Museum,
mm-hmm.
there were stories of vehicles that were hidden during the war behind false walls. They were just walled in with bricks or, you know, some type of other wall.
Sure.
Material, because they didn't want them to be found, to be looted during the war, and they said, you know, some cars were buried in vaults, or they were buried, just covered in plastic and buried, or you know, a material like that, but let's say burlap or something.
Sure.
Knowing that, you know, in a year or two, hopefully they were thinking they'd be able to unbury those vehicles and bring them back out without, you know, fear that they would be confiscated, taken, used for spoils of war, I guess.
Right.
So there's a lot of stories of vehicles that have been hidden away during the wartime, and especially World War II. There were a lot of this clandestine type thing happening just before the enemy invaded, and interesting that some of these cars made it only because of that. You know, that it was walled up, and only one person knew where this vehicle was for years and years, and then eventually went back and just chipped it out, and it was there.
Some still probably haven't been found because people passed away unexpectedly.
You know what?
And stuff.
That's a very interesting thought because that happens, and they'll find vehicles like that. It's just like a treasure hunt. You know, that's what they call the barn find.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, we've talked about that.
We've taken it a little bit sad. We've taken it a little bit spooky. Let's take it somewhere else. Hmm. What do you got?
I don't know if I've got anything that's less sad.
All right. Well, then let's take it to downright tragic.
Because the last two that I've got here
both
have sad elements to them, unfortunately, because that's how a lot of these cars transfer hands.
Yeah, that's true.
But there's some good news on the way, so we'll just go ahead and dig into it.
I won't break out the violin.
I'm going to show you another picture of this one. This is a 1937 Mercedes-Benz 540K Special Roadster.
Wow.
Also on display at the museum. And this is one of the ones maybe that got me thinking about this as a topic today.
Yeah, look at that.
This car, if you can imagine this car, this is a huge car.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like in person it seems like it's about 25 feet long. Big pipes coming out of the front end of it here.
Yeah.
Wrap around windshield. It's a beautiful car. Red leather interior, silver. This 540K Special Roadster, believe it or not, was a graduation gift to a 16-year-old girl in Germany.
What?
Yeah, exactly. She was a baroness. Her name was...
Okay.
Gisela von Krieger. That's her name, Gisela von Krieger. And so what happens was, you know, as the war breaks out, the family, the entire von Krieger family moves to Paris when the war begins, right? And then they moved on to London.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, the entire time they're fleeing the Nazis. And they're, as one person said it, they're always one step ahead in this fabulous 540K is how they worded it. Right?
Oh, wow.
Because it's like they're fleeing the Nazis in this fantastic car that we're looking at here. After that, they actually, when Paris finally fell, she was actually named one of the 10 most beautiful women in the world at that point. This baroness was. So it gives you a level, you know, an idea of what we're dealing with here is like, you know, the upper level of society,
sure.
The upper echelon here. After the war, the baroness immigrated to America and she took the car with her again on the Queen Mary. Okay.
We've
mentioned the Queen Mary a couple times.
Yeah.
So the car comes over here to the United States. She settles in Manhattan, and they have a homestead. They have a place in Greenwich, Connecticut. And they stored the vehicle, or she stored the vehicle for over 40 years in a shed in Greenwich, Connecticut. And this is beginning around 1953 until the early 1990s, Ben.
Wow.
She died, I want to say that she died around, I thought it was 1989, because they found her, I guess they, here's the way it went down. Someone who was a, he was a caretaker. Yeah, I think he's a caretaker at the Greenwich grounds, the facility.
Okay, sure.
He knew of the car, and he wanted to buy the car later in his life. He said, you know, I know she's got this car in storage. I want it. I'd like to, you know, put an offer in to her. So he tried to contact her, couldn't contact her. So he goes and, you know, convinces the landlord that, you know, I need to, you know, talk to her.
Visit her in person.
Yeah, exactly. So they go up and they knock on the door. You know, no one's there. They go inside. They discover that she's dead, and she's died in just these horrible conditions. They called it squalor. They said that it's just terrible conditions. So there's this baroness who's gone all the way down to this terrible condition, and I don't know if it's an apartment or what, but this is the late 80s, early 90s.
And held on to the car.
Exactly. She held on to the car the entire time. She never sold that vehicle because I think it was, you know, probably the last bit of that life that she was kind of hanging on to at that point. That's my guess of this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then it was finally sold. You know, it was part of the estate, and then it was finally sold to the current owners, which are the Harringtons. And the Harringtons own a fantastic collection. It's one of these, you know, enormous collections like you'd find in museums. You know, this is all part of one family's collection. And they finally restored it to its original condition, which is the way we see it now. And they said that they said it was in really, like, almost original condition. They said the paint was peeling off of it, and they even found cigarette butts in the ashtray that had the Baroness's lipstick on them.
Really?
And they found a white glove underneath the seat that belonged to her.
Wow.
So, you know, it's just interesting that this thing ever made it that long. I mean, it stayed in a shed in Connecticut for 40 years. I mean, and you look at it, and it's clearly – I mean, oh, you know what? As a capper to the story, after it was restored, it won Best in Class at Pebble Beach in 2004. So that's – I mean, it's the top of the top. When you're winning the Pebble Beach, you know, the Concours event.
You can't really go anywhere else.
Yeah, that's right. That's the upper end.
You can't even win the next year.
No. Exactly. Yeah.
You know what? I've got to say, man, you're making me feel like a bit of a heel for not making it to the museum. And boy, was that story tragic. We've got one more for him, right?
I do, and I'm going to give you an abbreviated version of this one because this is a complex, really complex one.
This is a boondoggle?
Yeah, I'm going to give you a picture here.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And a lot of readers will have read about this or seen this in the past years. I've heard about this thing for about 10 years now. That's how long it's been in the news. It's about the missing Daytona Coupe. And a lot of people say, oh, yeah, I know about that one right away.
And other people are going, go on.
This is one of the strangest stories you will ever hear about a car. And I encourage everybody to read about this one because the version that I'm going to give you here is just the Cliff Notes version. Super fast, but there's so much to this story. It's tough to even begin. You've got a picture in front of you, right?
Yes.
What do you see when you see that car? What do you say when you look at that picture?
Well, first off, you can tell this car is definitely made for speed. You can tell it's been through something, been through a lot, because the paint is messed up. There's dirt. Looks like there's some corrosion. Those tires are busted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the hubcap's looking rough. Doesn't even look like it's got the windows on the driver's side.
No, it's all broken down. It's got body filler. It's got looks like somebody scribbled something in yellow pen on the side, maybe. Paint of some kind, handwritten script.
It looks like it just barely made it out of wherever it made it.
It's a rough-looking car, to say the least, right?
Yes.
Okay, this is the now, just so you know what we're talking about, this is one of the the Shelby Cobra Roadsters, one of the six that were ever made, okay? And that should give you an idea right there.
Yeah.
That car right there that you're looking at is worth $4 million.
As is?
As is.
Wow.
As is, yep. And that's what it eventually went for, but there's a really complicated story that goes along with it. And it goes all the way back to, of course, Carroll Shelby. He was working on these Roadsters trying to beat Ferrari in its class. I think it was a GT class at the time. Because, you know, Ford had that intense competition with Ferrari at one point. You know, they wanted to buy them, wouldn't, said, okay, we'll beat you at your own game, et cetera. Okay, so then Ford decided that he wants Shelby to concentrate on the GT40 program, which you know is highly successful.
Sure.
But he had to give up this Daytona Cobra Coupe project that he was on, and they made six cars only. So he pretty much, I guess he just put the, Shelby put the cars up for sale. You know, these race cars are up for sale.
Got to recoup your loss somehow.
Exactly. And, you know, the specific one they're talking about is CSX 2287, and that was the first one that they made. And that one was sold originally to, and I'm going to just go through this quick, I swear, Jim Russell, who was a slot car shop owner in, where was it? Somewhere in California.
We also did slot cars, just a plug.
Exactly, yeah. He owned Ruskit Slot Cars, and I thought it was in California. Mm-hmm. Anyways, he sells the car to Phil Spector. Phil Spector, the...
The Wall of Sound producer,
exactly.
Famous for his work with the Beatles.
He sells the car to Phil Spector. Now, that was some kind of an odd thing, because there's another part of that story here where it says that when he tried to sell it, he couldn't talk directly to Phil. Because he's a bit of a recluse, right?
Right.
So he had this lawyer with him, and he drove it up to the house, and he had to stay outside with the car, and his lawyer went between the house and outside making the deal until they agreed on a price, and I think it was like $7,500 for this car. And finally, Phil came out, and he signed the check and handed it to him, and that was how the deal was done.
That's it?
That's it. And he saw him just that one time, and that was it. Now, Phil, you know, he's a recluse, like they say, and that's somebody who usually hides away. He's the one who painted all that stuff on the side of the car, on the doors.
Ah, okay.
And it says things like, you know, holder of, you know, X number of speed records on the Bonneville Salt Flats and driven by this person and won this race. And it's the history of the car.
It's the genealogy almost.
It's the genealogy of the car that he wrote out on the side of the car. Now, is that somebody who doesn't want attention?
That is someone who wants attention, at least for their car.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess he racked up a ton of speeding tickets in the car because it's a race car, right?
Right.
And he's got it on the street. So he eventually decides, like, I got to get rid of this thing, or somebody advises him to get rid of it. I think
the parking tickets alone, Philip.
He took it to a shop to see about, you know, converting it to street use, because It was already on the street, but it was getting really hot inside because that's what race cars do.
Sure.
And, you know, it wasn't a street car.
Comfort is not part of the equation.
Be honest about this, right? So the mechanic says that it would cost him a lot of money to convert it to a typical street car because, you know, it's very raw in the condition it's in right now. And he says that the mechanic offered to scrap it for $800. Okay. So Phil says, no way, I'm going to take it home. And this is where the story deviates in a lot of cases, because this eventually goes to court in modern day.
Okay.
Phil apparently, now this is all just hearsay, right?
Hearsay.
Okay. He apparently sold it to his bodyguard for about $1,000 because, you know, he's saying that he would have scrapped it for $800. He said, I'll give it to my bodyguard for $1,000. His bodyguard's name was George Brand. Now, George gave it to his daughter. Her name is Donna, Donna O'Hara. And Donna stashed away the car, wouldn't tell anybody where it was. She had a storage locker, right?
Okay.
She puts it in the storage locker, and it just sat there. It sat there for 30 years.
Oh, God.
30 years.
No wonder it was so beat up.
I know. It's unbelievable. So, okay. You know, we go all the way forward to the year 2000,
yep.
And we're nearing the end here, Ben, I promise.
No, from the 70s to 2000.
Yeah, we're up to 2000 now. Okay,
yeah.
So this is 30 years later. On October 22nd of the year 2000, they find Donna O'Hara on she's on a hiking trail.
Okay.
You know what immolation is?
Yes.
She set
herself on fire.
She set herself on fire. She had a couple of gallons of gasoline. She poured half of one onto herself.
Oh, no.
Lit herself on fire. Didn't do the job. Didn't kill her. So she's in terrible pain.
Oh, no.
Police find her on the trail. She lived for something like 15 hours, Ben.
Still, oh, wow.
Yeah, and but she did die that day. And she wouldn't tell them her name, wouldn't tell them anything about her. When they asked her name, she just told them to shut up. So just outright said, I'm not going to tell you anything. Shut up, I want to die. Yeah, exactly. She was saying, I want to die.
Wow.
The weird part, well, that's weird.
Yeah.
She also did that to two of her pet rabbits. So they found two of her pet rabbits along with her on the trail. Strange.
Wow, there's something going on there.
I know,
there.
Really, really bizarre. I guess she was just about to be fired. She was divorced. She was just always this really, really cautious character that stayed herself. Very strange. I guess Carol Shelby even had gone to her and said, I want to buy this car. Now, over the years, over the 3 decades,
yeah,
some people knew about this car. And the offers started coming in. Like one of her childhood friends said, hey, I'll buy that car from you and, you know, help you pay off your house and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know what? Maybe that's not – hang on one second. I think I might have misspoken there. Hang on. One guy – sorry about this, Ben, but you know what? It was an attorney representing Kurt Goss. So that was right. One of her childhood friends. Mm-hmm. The attorney said, I'll give you $500,000 for that car.
Wow.
And she said, no way. You know, just get off my property or something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. The offers began to advance, and they knew, you know, that she had the car. Carroll Shelby himself eventually went to her with a $2 million offer.
$2 million.
Yeah. It just went up and up and up, right?
Yeah.
So.
And she said no every time.
Exactly. She said no every time. So maybe Shelby was only $1 million now that I think about it. Anyways, we're getting, you know, it gets to the point where it's very, very expensive.
Right. And she's still not folding.
Exactly. So she dies, and Goss, you remember this childhood
yes.
friend? He knows of the car, of course, and he says that she had instructed him, if anything happens to her, to take care of all of her belongings, including four cars. The one that she had in storage, plus three others, which were like an MG, Geo Metro, and something else. I forget what the other one was.
One of those things is not like the other.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So he says, okay, that's including the cars, and I have rights to get into the storage, and she had indeed written his name as one with access to the storage unit.
So lucky break.
He goes over, you know, cuts the uses the bolt cutters to cut off the lock and finds the car there, puts a new lock on, et cetera. Then he goes about, you know, saying, I've got this great car. He didn't take it at that time. He tells her mother about her own daughter's death because she had no idea. She's such a recluse that she didn't know.
Wow.
This is like a month later.
Okay.
Her mother says, hey, I found this. You know, she's going through her things, her personal things in her house, finds this letter for an offer of $2 million for this car in storage, says, well, yeah, I'm going to call this guy, and, you know, we're going to get the $2 million, yeah. Thinking that, you know, it goes to her because she's the mother. Okay, sorry. No. I'm getting out of breath here. She calls the person who made the offer for $2 million, but she had done a research and found out that one had gone for $4 million prior to this, one of the other six.
Ah, smart.
And knowing that this one is in rough condition, you know, the guy said, well, I can give you two for it. And she said, I don't think that's going to do it. How about three? Because the $4 million was her perfect version, a restored version. She says, how about three? And he says, okay. It's $3 million bucks. So here's her 78-year-old mother who's now, got $3 million for this car. But Goss still thinks he owns it. He thinks that he's got possession of that property, even though.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. So she sold the car. She's sold the car to someone. He takes it and, you know, takes it away. Sells it to another collector on the East Coast. I think it was a surgeon, a doctor of some kind.
Oh, no.
Sells it for something like $3,750,000 or something like that, right? And, it just goes on and on like this. And then it was auctioned for $4 million. So it's up to $4 million at this point. However, the mother that sold it for $3 million gave away a portion of her money to a charity and I think like $850,000 to some friends. And then the attorney said, wait, you didn't have right to sell that. So he's tied up the other $2 million that she had. So she can't even access
it's like frozen.
And she owes fees for the money that he says she still owes, the other $2 million.
Oh, man.
So there's this big thing going on, right? And then during all this court proceeding, Phil Spector sends an attorney who's a messenger to say he never sold the car. He just thought he was giving it to Brand to store it for him.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Really, Philip?
Really. Yeah, so Phil Spector gets involved again, and this is in, you know, mid-2000s, I guess.
Okay.
Before his little trouble. Big trouble, I should say. But the attorney is Robert Shapiro. Remember OJ's attorney?
Yeah.
So this thing has got all these great big names involved with it. And so Robert Shapiro is there saying, no, it's Phil Spector's car, and here's why. And, they had no right to sell it, and Brand had no right to have it. Brand is now 90 years old.
Yeah.
His daughter is dead.
Wow.
The wife, who's 80, has sold it already, you know, and given the money away, some of it anyways, and it's all tied up. And it's just a big mess. But this car has this unbelievable twist, you know, the history that's involved with this thing.
Yeah.
And I promise you – now, I know that was long. I apologize, but –
Why do you got to stop apologizing, man?
No, I know. It shouldn't have been that long, but that's the Cliff Notes version of what's really going on here.
Bare bones.
If you read this thing, it's more twisted than what I've told you. It's got more twists and turns, and there's just incredible things happening with this vehicle. Mm. And I think that, you know, This is pretty unusual, but I think that there's a lot more. There are a lot more out there like this.
Yeah,
where there are stories that are really complex, mm-hmm. and if you take time to read about them and understand the history, I think that a lot of these are, they're better than fiction, really.
And if you actually own a vehicle that is used or that you're uncertain of, as far as its history, it just goes to show, man. A lot of the cars we picked, obviously, are very high-end, recognizable cars, mm-hmm. but you never know what happened to your car before you did, unless there was a smoker driving it. You can always tell if there was a smoker.
Yeah, sure. You may have a celebrity's car in your garage. You never know.
Right. I don't, but somebody...
You could have the John Voight car, remember? from Seinfeld. we had a Jeep one time that was owned by Bob Eaton when he was but it was a different Bob Eaton.
Really?
Yeah, we bought it in the Eaton of Chrysler.
It was a different Bob Eaton.
But it was a Bob Eaton in Detroit mm-hmm. at the right time when he was president.
So that you can say that.
Yeah, exactly. Basically. We had Bob Eaton's Jeep.
Okay, guys, so this about wraps up for us. Obviously, we have presented some very high-value, unique vehicles, but it doesn't mean that they are by any means the only vehicles with a story out there. You may own a used car and be surprised by what happened to it before it became part of your life. So we'd like to send out a call to everybody listening out there in the internet land. You guys, thanks so much for hanging out with us again. And check with our Facebook, Car Stuff. Check with our Twitter at Car Stuff as well. And Scott's awesome blog. And if you have a story that you think the rest of the listeners should hear about your unusual car or someone you know, send us an email at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.
So, should we go electric?
I think we should go electrified with Toyota.
Electrified?
Electrified means options. Yes, we could go all electric with a Toyota bZ4X, but then there are hybrids like Grand Highlander, or we could do something in between like a RAV4 plug-in hybrid.
So Toyota is electrified, diversified?
Yep, and with more options for reducing carbon emissions, the closer we all get to Toyota's Beyond Zero vision for the future.
Exactly how much coffee have you had this morning?
Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Viking. Committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.